This could be one mechanism that warming may impact eventually fish biomass in the long run. Second, there's a temperature size rule. It's one explanation related to how exotherms grow. In warmer waters, fish often experience increased growth rates initially, but they ultimately reach smaller adult body size. This could explain the initial increase in fish biomass during short-term warming due to faster individual growth. But over the long term, a population made up of smaller adults may also mean less total biomass. So this is one point that should be investigated more into depth, although there's a good evidence for that across the Mediterranean Sea. Another potential explanation could be prey-predator disruptions. We have evidence that long-term climate changes can disrupt prey-predator dynamics. Studies show that smaller species' predation rates can increase in warmer temperature, but decrease for bigger individuals. So when we combine physically smaller fish, less available food, and disrupted biological interactions, you get pervasive impact of climate. So it could be different mechanisms that eventually converge.
And which is the bigger threat to rich ocean life? Is it long-term general ocean warming or extreme marine heat waves? Were you able to sort that out in this new work?
That was actually our goal, to disentangle long-term warming from short-term warming. This is, I think, where the novelty lays. We show that the overarching threat is the long-term warming. Marine heat waves have a local context-dependent impact. They shift biomass around, creating localized winners and losers. But chronic long-term warming is apparently an inescapable threat. We found that both cold-edge and warm-edge populations are equally vulnerable to chronic warming. It slowly and persistently reduces the biomass.
Well, suppose one country finds a huge increase in a species that it wants to harvest, and it sends out boats to get it, not knowing there has been a collapse of the same species closer, say, to the warm edge. Could this mixed reaction to warming lead to mistakes in controlling commercial fisheries?
Yes, this is one of our biggest warnings. If a country that occupies a cold edge of a particular commercial species sees a massive, let's say 150% boom in European sprat during a warm year, they might heavily increase their fishing quotas because they say, well, we're doing fine, a lot of fish, we can increase the quotas in this case. But if they don't realize that the species is simultaneously collapsing at its warm edge in a completely different region and declining globally due to chronic warming, they risk overexploiting this stock based on these transient gains.
Well, it sounds like we might need international management of the fisheries, as difficult as that might be. What does your paper tell us about prospects for fisheries management in coming years and decades?
I think that is exactly the danger. I was thinking about marine heat wave-induced transient gains. If a country happens to be located at the cold edge of a species range, marine heat wave might cause its local fisheries to suddenly boom. They might look at those record catches and say, what climate crisis? Everything's fine, and increase their fishing quotas, right? But this is exactly why we urgently need international collaboration. Most fish species distributions span multiple countries. If we only manage fisheries on a national level, a country at the cold edge might exploit what are actually transient, temporary gains, completely ignoring that the overall biomass of that exact same species is collapsing next door at its warm edge. So if we don't manage the stock as a whole, we risk overexploiting these localized booms. To survive the coming decades, I believe fisheries management needs a bi-temporal management approach. First, we need agile, short-term, climate-ready plans. This means that cross-border agreements to implement temporary fishing closures in warm-edge regions during extreme marine heat waves, while strictly monitoring the booms in the cold edges. Second, we must establish long-term strategies that don't rely on these temporary spikes, but actually prepare for the homogeneous decline of fish biomass that chronic warming is driving across the globe.
What are you working on next?
I'm incredibly excited about my next project because it tries to fix a major challenge in how we currently predict climate impacts on marine life. Right now, most of our predictions rely on oceanographic metrics, like defining a marinid wave just because the temperature crosses a certain historical percentile across the baseline. But that assumes that all species respond the same way to a statistical anomaly and basically just assumes warmer is worse. So it lacks direct biological relevance. Survival is not just about how hot the water gets, it's also about how long the fish is exposed to that heat. So thermal stress is a cumulative process, not just a momentary event. So what I'm working on now is with colleagues is bridging up the gap between ocean physics and actual fish physiology. So we're combining ecologists and physiologists in this work. We're integrating fish surveys with daily temperature data, as we did, and laboratory-derived thermal tolerances that will measure different locations around the globe in different independent studies. Instead of just looking at traditional marine heat wave thresholds, we are trying to focus on the mortality probability. So we will add a macrophysiology component to our estimates, hopefully achieving more accurate responses of fishes to a warming world.
I'll be looking for your work going forward from Spain. We've been speaking with marine ecologist Shahar Chaikin. He is the lead author of the new paper, Long-Term Warming Reduces Fish Biomass, But Heat Waves Shift It. That was published February 25th in Nature Ecology and Evolution. You can find links to follow up in my weekly show blog at ecoshock.org. Shahar, I look forward to your new work, and thanks for spending time with our listeners.
Thank you very much for having me.
I'm Alex Smith for Radio EcoShock. Wherever you live, we suffer through extreme heat waves. On Greenland, amplified heating leads to extreme melt events that haven't been counted up to now, and they can change the ocean and the weather far away. Water from Greenland glaciers could eventually flood coasts and drown island nations. It takes a long time, though, right? Except new science shows record-breaking Greenland ice sheet melt events. Just like short but deadly heat waves, extreme ice events are here and they are growing. The lead author in this new science, published February 26th in Nature Communications, is Dr. Josep Bonsoms.
Thank you very much for the introduction.
Right, and you're a researcher and postdoctoral lecturer at University of Barcelona in Spain, and you did your PhD about climate impacts on glaciers in Greenland. What is an extreme melting event on Greenland, and please describe one?
One extreme melting event is a kind of a heat wave, but for heat wave, we normally quantify the impact of a heat wave based on air temperature. And for extreme melting, instead of using air temperature, we use meltwater variables, which are modeled using regional climate models. But it can be also modeled using, I have observed it based on remote sensing data or automatic weather stations. So basically, an extreme melting event is a period of melting in the ice sheet. And this is driven by thermodynamics and circulation changes.
Are these melting events mostly clustered near the ocean, or can they happen deep inland or even at high elevations?
It can happen everywhere. Like in Greenland, we have peripheral glaciers and ice caps outside of the ice sheet. Then we have the ice sheet, and there's also many parts of Greenland that are covered by seasonal snow cover. So an extreme melting event can happen everywhere in the island.
Your paper describes a number of extreme melt events developing in Greenland, but does not reveal how long these events last. Is an extreme melt measured in days or weeks or what?
Yeah, basically an extreme melting event can be quantified in days, but also in months. And it's normally quantified using a percentile approach, so the days that are over the 95 or 99 percentile based on historical climate data are classified into extreme melting episodes. And we know very well that extreme melting events are increasing in frequency, so the number of days of extreme melting are increasing, but also the magnitude and also the spatial extension of extreme melting in the ice sheet is moving towards higher elevation. So in the past, we had melting events only next to the ablation area, but now because of climate change, we're observing also an increase of melting in the accumulation area and in other parts than in the past was very, it was not very frequent to observe extreme melting.
Well, scientists have long studied and modeled how much the Greenland ice sheet is melting and its contribution to sea level rise. They developed standards based on long-term melting. How does the loss of water during extreme melt events compare to that general glacier loss over a year or over a decade? Is it significant?
Yeah, normally in the Antarctic and the Greenland ice sheet are contributing to the sea level rise in the entire Earth. And then we have another factor, which is thermal expansion. I mean, the thermal expansion of the ocean. So basically, the melting, the Greenland ice sheet accumulates ice and snow during winter, but then during summer, there's positive temperatures that drive melting, especially in the ablation area and in the peripheral areas of Greenland. So there are many parts of the Greenland ice sheet where the total accumulation minus the ablation is negative, but there are still some places in the ice sheet in the accumulation area where there are gains of mass during the total year.
It's easy to assume the cause of extreme melting on Greenland is just global warming. The Arctic's warming about four times faster than the rest of the world. Is the general warming the main driver of these extreme melts, or what did you find is making these things happen?
We found that the increase of extreme melting is driven by thermodynamics, which is the increase of temperature under the same circulation weather types. So this is explained because there's more energy available for melting in the atmosphere, and this is totally linked with the greenhouse gases emissions. So in the end, the increase of greenhouse gases drives more incoming and long-wave radiation. Also because the albedo, so the reflectivity of the ice sheet is decreasing. And then there's another factor related with the circulation, so the air masses movement. And we detected that there's an increase of the blocking events, so the anticyclonic weather events during summer in Greenland that drive extreme melting. So in the end, we have more temperature, but also an increase of the synoptic conditions that can drive positive higher temperature and, in the end, extreme melting events.
It was first reported in 2012 that surface melting had occurred virtually across the entire Greenland ice sheet, including the normally frigid region at the highest elevations. I remember when that happened. Tell us about that extreme melt event.
Yeah, in August and July 2012, as well as in 2019 and more recently in 2021 and 2023, there were extraordinary melting events in the ice sheet that were driven by anticyclonic weather systems, so by blocking conditions over the ice sheet during the summer. So the decrease of the albedo, so the reflectivity of the Greenland ice sheet, amplified this positive temperature. And especially during 2012, the melting was also recorded in the summit area of Greenland, and it was especially important because they compared the extreme melting event of 2012 with previous melting events, also using paleoclimate data, so using ice cores, and they realized that the event of 2012 was very extraordinary and not observed in many paleoclimate registers. So these kind of events are happening now more frequently because of the increase of temperature in Greenland. And we know very well that, for instance, the event of 2012 or 2019, they don't have a dynamic precedent, so they don't have any synoptic precedent in the historical climate period.
Wow. So this, as far as we know, is not a normal state. It has never happened before.
Yeah, at least when I say like historical climate period, I refer to 1950, when we have one of the most used terrain analysis data. But for these extremely melting events, such as 2012 or 2019, we know very well that they are very rare in the entire late Holocene to present evolution of the climate in Greenland.
Okay, and you find the number of extreme melt events on Greenland are increasing and becoming more intense in recent decades. So you found records and methods documenting increasing melt events on Greenland. What happens if you take that upward curve of events and model it out, say, for 2 degrees of warming by 2100 or even 3 or 4 degrees of warming?
We know also very well that if we follow the current greenhouse gases emissions scenario, by the end of the century, these kind of extreme melting events can happen around 3 times the magnitude of the present day magnitude. So we know that that each degree of temperature matters, although we have the Greenland ice sheet, so all of the ice in the ice sheet will be still conserved even in 2300.
On Radio EcoShock, Dr. Andrew Crist explained large parts of Greenland have been ice-free within the last million years. That's very surprising. And then on the other end of the world, NASA scientists said some Antarctic glaciers have passed a point of no return, saying they were sort of unstoppable and irreversible. In your expert opinion, Josep, do you expect large parts of Greenland to become ice-free eventually? And if so, what kind of timetables are possible in a rapidly warming world?
We know that in the mid-Holocene, the temperatures were slightly higher than in the present day, but because of natural climate variability. And since the 90s, we are observing also an abrupt increase of temperature and melting in the Greenland ice sheet. But this is not explained by natural climate variability. It's explained because of the increase of greenhouse gases emissions scenario, as well as the albedo decay in the glacial and especially in the southern parts of Greenland. So we know very well that the accumulation area of Greenland, many parts of the accumulation area, will be covered by ice and by snow in the next 300 years. But we also know very well that the equilibrium line altitude of the Greenland ice sheet and the ablation area will move towards higher elevations, and there's a big confidence about these changes by the end of the century and in the next century.
The year 2023 set all kinds of records, from hottest year ever to that point, and deadly heat waves across the world. Canada was on fire. There were marine heat waves. Did the 2023 El Nino hot year set any Greenland meltwater records?
Yeah, in Greenland, there was a big melting event in the end of 2023, in the end of the summer, so in August. And El Niño is indirectly related with the melting of the Greenland ice sheet because it modifies the North Atlantic ocean climate patterns. And in the end, it can change the circulation weather types in the Greenland ice sheet. So normally they are connected. Also the circulation weather types in the Arctic are connected with the climate in Northern Europe. So in the end, all of the climate system is interconnected. And in 2023, we also observed an extreme melting event in the Greenland ice sheet.
Anybody paying attention hears about extreme weather events all over the world. But until now, I did not know about extreme melting events on Greenland. Is there a place or a community where this is being monitored? And how can it be communicated like it's a news event?
Well, there are many projects, especially in the University of Copenhagen, for instance. We are working also with people from the University of Liège that they develop a regional climate model, but then there are other people working in the same topic in the University of Amsterdam, and then also people in the labs in Switzerland and in the United States, for sure. I think it's important to communicate that, and there are many platforms and places that we can translate the results into some kind of news that can be understandable for most of the population. For instance, I'm thinking about YouTube platforms or even in social media, and there are also kind of events that are very useful for translate the scientific results into the political sector, such as the COPs, the Conference of Parties, that are organized every year. So I think that there are many ways of explaining the results that we are finding in science into a broad society and for the political sector.
From the University of Barcelona, we've been speaking with researcher and postdoctoral lecturer Josep Bonsoms. We talked about his new paper called Record-Breaking Greenland Ice Sheet Melt Events Under Recent and Future Climate. You can find links and more in my show blog at ecoshock.org. Josep, thank you for spending time with our listeners.
Thank you very much, Alex, for the interview.
I'm Alex Smith for Radio EcoShock.
Check out the Radio EcoShock website. We're at ecoshock.org.
O heavenly grid, help us spare up thy standard, our chevron flashing bright across the Gulf of Compromise.
So in March, during the Gulf debacle, 32 member countries of the International Energy Agency, including Japan, the United States, and European nations, agreed to release oil from the national reserves. Experts have serious reservations about whether opening petroleum reserves will accomplish anything meaningful. The oil reserve promised represents about 4 days' worth of global consumption, 100 million barrels a day, more or less, versus 400 million barrels promised from the reserves. Getting the oil out of those reserves is quite slow. In the United States, experts estimate it will take 4 months to deliver 172 million barrels of oil from the strategic reserve, as promised by the Trump administration. Meanwhile, prices stay high. This reserve seems more like a ploy, a mirage. The transfer may be stopped at any time by the president if he changes his mind. There is no obligation to tell the public if that happens. The one-time show for the stock market has been expended. Actual delivery over several months does little and may not happen. Of course, it's possible for all countries, including America, that nobody should be releasing their reserves right now. There is a lot longer and likely a lot worse to go. Reserves used now to keep transportation and industry as is, without any sacrifices or cutbacks, will seem wasted if that fuel is needed just to keep food trucks going later, hospitals operating, and other essential services. In the meantime, I think recreational flying needs to be dropped. Gas rationing is already in the works for several countries, and factories will shut down. More countries will only offer electricity for a few hours a day, or not at all. There is no oil reserve for natural gas, by the way. For a lot of countries, especially in Asia, either the gas just stops, or an insane bidding war grabs gas vessels on the open sea that were intended for Europe or somewhere else. For a lot of people, the gas just stops until peace arrives, and likely for months after that.
You say we're on the brink of destruction, and you're right. But it's only on the brink that people find the will to change. Only at the precipice do we evolve.
We need to talk about food, and if food fails, mass migration and its impact on politics happen. Agricultural experts say we are entering a nightmare scenario for global fertilizer markets. Between 30 and 50% of all the nitrogen-rich fertilizer, ammonia, sulfur for phosphate fertilizers, all go through the bottleneck of Hormuz. That fertilizer has stopped flowing out to the world. According to the United Nations report on closing the strait, Pakistan will be deprived of more than a quarter of the fertilizer, keeping their 250 million people alive. Half the fertilizer for the war-torn state of Sudan comes through the strait. At least, it did. The real impact, including mass hunger or starvation, may not show up this summer or even in the fall, until crops fail or the harvest is greatly reduced, as agriculturally addicted fossil fuel fertilizer disappears. This war will have a long tail of difficulties not easy to see now.
and that all of this is much more dangerous than one thinks, and it's not just a question of individual survival, Wally, but that somebody who's bored is asleep, and somebody who's asleep will not say no.
Meanwhile, the climate emergency continues and grows. We will keep an eye on it together here. I'm Alex Smith. Download any interview or music you hear in this program free at equalshock.org. Pass them on. Thank you for listening and caring about our world.
I'm gonna let you go into the heat. I'll drive around to see it. I'll fly around to make it. I'll live the way it always was. I'm in the driver's seat for the heat. Loaned on the cheap, never know, never wake up to the heat.
Listening to CJSF 90.1 FM, SFU's community radio station, broadcasting live from Burnaby, BC.
This is Bird Note. On winter holiday with her son in Cancun, writer Amy Nezuko-Matatil was in a bit of a funk. She was coming to terms with her first kid imminently leaving the nest to go off to college. This trip was where he wanted to go, a kind of high school graduation gift. But Amy, not so much. She's known for writing about nature and wonderment. And the most touristy part of Cancun was not her idea of a good time. But that first night there inspired this short poem.
My son reminds me he was listening all along. Just when I think there is so much I have yet to teach him before he flies off to college. Look up, he points. From the balcony, our first night in Cancun, a whole flock of magnificent frigate birds night feeding, their white necks lit from the glow on Hotel Row.
Amy had always tried to instill a love of nature in her kids, taking them hiking or birding, teaching them the names of plants. On that balcony, she was moved by her teenage son's open wonderment.
It was so magical. I get teary-eyed thinking about it. Like, all the times he was rolling his eyes at me,
he learned something to look up, you know, like even when I was just disgusted, frustrated, like I wasn't where I wanted to be for the holidays, he kind of taught me a lesson too.
This poem is in Amy's new book, Night Owl. Find a link at our website, birdnote.org. I'm Mark Bramhill.